The Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio is on the air.
No, sorry about that. I didn't know it was going to kick over that quick. That was my crazy blender. What's going on? It's Davey.
How you doing? How's the weather out there in California?
It's kind of cold today because I live in, so it's kind of by the water. Right. So it's a little funky out today. But, you know, I'll survive.
All right. So if you're ready, we can just get rolling here.
All right, let's do it.
You're listening to Third Eye Cinema, your source for in-depth discussion of cult cinema. Tonight, one of my all-time favorite singer-songwriters, glam metal legend Davey Veen, on the Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio. Cinema, where the focus is on film that matters, cult, grindhouse, drive-in, independent, and underground film, from the dawn of the talkies to the early 90s. Tonight we'll be speaking with singer-songwriter, producer, and glam metal legend Davey Veen. With his moody and introspective take on melodic Hollywood-style metal, Davey's marked a trail all his own, creating an expressive, emotional, and often angst-ridden sound, unafraid to explore the vagaries of life, love, and sex on the seedier side of the street. While mainstream audiences know him best for his flawless Island Records debut, No Respect, despite the collapse of his record company and shelving of his fully completed and promoted second album and the untimely onslaught of grunge, Davey and his band Van have continued putting out a steady flow of consistently solid releases, which stay close to the original template while still adapting to the changing times. With his latest album, Enough Rope, Davey has brought the entire original lineup back together, and with continued tours of Europe and the U.S., Davey remains a vibrant and vital force in hard rock and metal with an existential flair. Join us to speak to the one and only Davey Veen, only here on Third Eye Cinema. In our first segment, we'll talk a bit about his producer work, from Death Angel to Christina Aguilera, and a bit about his vocal style. But first, just to give you an idea of what we're talking about, here's Veen off one of my favorite of their albums, All Those Strangers. This is Far Away. Tonight, we're talking music, and we have with us a man who's taken a very unique approach to metal. With a moody, dark, and driven feel, his lyrics and vocals are both introspective and expressive, with a strong feeling of existential angst that veers between a softer, more melancholy side and an aggressive rage against the engagement of life, love, and sex on the seedier side of the street. Ladies and gentlemen, I present one of my all-time favorite singer-songwriters, Davey Vane. Davey, welcome
to
the show. How you doing?
What was that? I'm doing good, good, man. Thank you, thank you. That's quite an introduction. Makes me sound like I need to do something mysterious on the air. But I am calling naked, so that's probably going to have to just do.
That'll do.
Now, I'm not your favorite anymore now, huh?
But seriously, you actually started out as a producer. I recall seeing your name not only on your own records, but on, of all things, Death Angel's only good album, The Ultraviolence. So that background and knowledge plays into the Vane sound, since between the fact that you're the main songwriter, lyricist, band leader, and then producer, you have pretty much total control over the music from start to finish?
At the start, I don't know if the production played into it. I think more I was just kind of learning how to do that at the time, too. I really started out as a singer first, and then I switched. I was like our first kid band, you know, and then we all got in a fight, and they kicked me out. And I remember the call. It's like, dude, we just got a dude, and he could sing Stairway to Heaven just like the record. And I was like, oh, wow. Yeah. It's like, I felt like I was still learning. We didn't even do any covers. We just made up stuff, you know, which I always thought was cool and helped me kind of start. It was like three kids and some older hippie dude that we jammed with that was a pro, and the only reason he played with us probably because no one would jam with them and play his songs. So he would just play riffs, and I would just make up vocals, and he gave me a lot of confidence saying, hey, man, you know, you've got this really cool sound to your voice. Just keep doing your thing, you know. And then when I got kicked out of the band, I was like, oh, you know, by the drummer, my buddy that brought me in, I was like, okay, what do I do? So then I started playing guitar more and writing songs, the music too. And then I did that for a while till I started Vane, and then I went back to singing again. So I'd only been really singing for like 3 years when we did No Respect, because the time in between when I first sang, I was just playing guitar and even did a couple gigs playing guitar in a couple of other bands. And then my manager, one of the last band I was in before I started Vane, I sang on a demo because I wanted the band to hear one of my songs. My current manager heard it and said, hey, I'm gonna, you know, played it for Kirk Hammett of Metallica, and he really dug it and said, hey, I like this guy's voice, he sounds really cool, I'm getting into production. So then he produced my first demo, then I started doing Vane, and then my manager started working with Death Angel, and they were just inexperienced, so they came to me and said, hey, this guy's good in studios, and because I kind of worked on some other stuff in the studios and was getting really good with guitar tone, so I came in and started helping them. Then they asked me to do the other record, then a bunch of other people started doing it, so I just kind of fell in, kind of getting into that and learning more about it. But I was still kind of, compared to what I know now, you know, it's just like, I probably would have really fucked up the Death Angel record. You know what I mean? But it's just like, you know, now I know so much more. But it did help, because I think the more thing about having the control over the band, which, you know, I try to do in as the coolest way possible and keep everybody happy, but I really had a vision of what I wanted to do, and they knew that I was writing the songs, and I had a vision of how I wanted to sing them and everything, and so everybody's just kind of rolling with that, and everybody was happy. There was never any like, hey, how come I can't do this, or how come I can't do that? They were kind of all on my side and wanted me to roll like that. And then when we did No Respect, since I did have some production credits on some of the other records that I did, then they let me be the co-producer or assistant producer, whatever I think the title was. And so then when we worked with Paul Norfield on the record, you know, let me really have a lot of control of kind of the overall sound, and I really wanted it to sound, because I was a little worried when we picked him at first that it would maybe be a little technical, because he'd done like Operation Mindcrime, Queensryche, and I loved that he could get these great sounds, but I still wanted it to be sleazy like a Sex Pistols record too, you know, because my voice already isn't that aggressive as like an Axl Rose or something like that necessarily, you know? It's already got a little bit more of a sometimes a sweeter vibe or something like that too. So I didn't want to do some commercial big record. So, but he said, hey, no problem. You know what we'll do is we'll just throw on, I'll have a Sex Pistols record then. I'll throw it on once in a while. And if you think it's not, you know, if it doesn't sound like it's in that ballpark, then we know if something's wrong, you know? So he ended up being cool. And then the record company was completely cool to let me do that too. And they gave us complete artistic control, and you know, the band all wanted to do what I wanted to do, so I really got to have my vision. Like, if you really listen to No Respect, the background vocal stuff are really quiet, too. And I just thought, you know what, I think maybe that's going to be a really dated thing if we put a bunch of big, huge vocals. Let's make it sound more like you're listening to a band playing, and, you know, so that's how it all kind of came together to make that all happen. And we couldn't have picked a more perfect person to, as a producer with Paul Norfield, to kind of help us get that vision, you know. And there was times when we would put a record on, like the Sex Pistols or something like that, and go, okay, cool, sounds like, you know, a real band playing, you know, we're getting the sound, you know.
So more recently, you have an even more unusual credit in terms of production. You co-produced the Christina Aguilera album. How did that come about?
Yeah, that was actually an engineer was my credit. Engineer. How that came about is my studio, not my own studio that I've had for quite a few years now, like tons of vintage equipment and stuff that I've collected over the years that I really like to work with. And Linda Perry, the person that wrote Beautiful, Get the Party Started with Pink and stuff, she was kind of making a comeback, and she came to my studio because she liked a lot of the gear, and we worked together on some of her new songs, and Beautiful was one of them, and we recorded them all at my studio. So then when she had the big hit, as when she turned to a producer to do the Pink stuff, then Christina came to her and wanted songs, so she let Christina hear Beautiful, and Christina really wanted to do it, and I had met Christina before because my manager used to manage her, and, you know, I knew her when she first started, you know, from the Gene your bottle days and all that. So then Linda called me and said, hey, I'm going to redo Beautiful again, and Christina's going to do it. And I go, you're kidding, you know? She goes, yeah, you want to come down and work on it with me? And I go, yeah, man, that'd be cool. So we came down and recorded everything and just did it really, if you hear the original recordings, they're even like cooler how it came out. We did it like with all the best gear and really did it vintage and like a Beatles thing and had a string section and the oldest mics and rented these crazy old compressors that her and me were geeking off on, and it was really cool. And the funny thing about it, too, is we were in the session, we had everything set up the next day, and Christina was supposed to show up, but she was late, like, twice, right? So we'd been there waiting all day, and she kept calling, it'd be later, and I'm like, man, this sucks. And I'm like, what do you want to do? And she goes, I don't know. And I go, why don't we just go to a strip club? She goes, okay, that's cool. So there's a strip club next door. So we went to the strip club. We went, and we really jacked to go to the strip club. We thought it would be a good way to kill time while we wait for the pop diva to show up, you know?
Right.
So we're like, all of a sudden, we're at the strip club. We hear all this loud noise, and we're like, what the hell? And it turned out for some reason it was some night where they had some trashy band in the corner of the strip club. And we're like, oh, man, that's kind of fucking loud, you know? I don't know if I'm allowed to cuss on the air. Sorry.
No, you're good.
Okay. And we go, I don't know if we can really go in there. You know, we're going to record, like, one of the biggest singers in the world in like a couple hours. I don't know if we really want to go in there and get our ears blasted with some drums or something. It might not be that good. And then all of a sudden, right as I said that, the two hottest strippers you've ever seen like poked out of the thing and looked around and looked right at us and walked back, and I go, screw it, we'll put some cotton in, man, we're going in. So we went there and hung out for a while. Then we went back to the session, and then Christina showed up. And we actually, before we even started recording, we just sat around and drank wine and partied. And it's funny because people think, oh, the Christina Aguilar thing sounds like so un-rock, you know. But I think we were all more wasted on that session than I'd been on many rock sessions that I've done where people have it way more together. I mean, we were, like, really loaded towards the end of it. People were slurring words and arguing about takes, and it was pretty funny, actually. And it turned out to be, and she ended up winning a Grammy for it, which was cool. So if you're involved in that, you all get a little Grammy certificate. So something to show mom, you know. It's like, you know, instead of those pictures of me, you know, half naked in the leather pants, look at this, a Grammy certificate, mom.
With the good portion of the L.A. bands, particularly the ones that could fall under the glam umbrella, getting some respect and airtime in that recent Hollywood Rocks collection, why the hell was Vane overlooked? Because I like a lot of the bands that they chose, but I was a bit miffed that a band as good as you guys were didn't get a single track or mention, and you can't even argue that it was because you guys are San Francisco-based, because Jet Boy was on there.
Oh, yeah. I don't know. I didn't even know anything about it, to be honest with you.
Wow.
That's probably why. Yeah, you know, I don't try to worry about stuff like that, to be honest with you, you know?
Yeah.
It's like we get asked to do some stuff, and we're kind of concentrating so much in Europe the last few years. I haven't even played in America in like 3 years, and I really want to. I've just been going over there a lot and just writing songs and just kind of doing my own thing, and I'm not trying to figure out how to – I don't let anything bother me. Otherwise, I might as well just drink a bottle of Jack every night and watch my old videos. You know what I mean? You know? I can't let stuff get to me anymore.
That's
I just
true.
Want to
That's
keep true. Making stuff the best that I can and just try to still be a real artist like I always was. I always wanted to make records that – I could listen to you, like I used to say 10 years, but it's been like 20 years now,
right,
that I would still be proud of and go, you know what, I didn't just make a bunch of bullshit to try to get on MTV. I wanted to be like a real rock band, you know? And so
exactly.
I think I've accomplished that, and I'm happy about that, and I like the new stuff that I'm doing. I even like some of the strange little songs that I've done on other records that people don't like. You know, I've always tried to just do stuff that I really like an artist, and I've always thought of myself as more of that than trying to be like a big rock star or something like that. And so if something like that happens, I try not to
yeah.
go like, oh, no, you know. But I know what you're saying. Dude, I have people sometimes coming up to me after every show, at least one or two people going, you guys should have been so big. You're my favorite band ever. But I just try not to drudge up what happened and how things went wrong, because
yeah.
otherwise, you, like you said, you just might as well just get loaded every night, you know? Because when we started, it was just like a skyrocket, and we never played a show anywhere on our first tours after we were signed where somebody didn't come up and go, listen, I've seen every band. You guys are going to be huge. I know. I've picked every band, every magazine. Like Robert Plant came to see me sing, you know? It was just
right.
like, you know, it was just like that and like that. And then for the whole record company to get sold and everything to just go down like just like the space shuttle. And then, you know, a couple years later, the whole grunge thing came in. So then all our careers were completely cut short at the prime, you know? So you couldn't
exactly.
rebound at all. So if you really just let all that get to you, you could really freak out. And then I did the thing with Steven Adler for a year, which
right.
had amazing potential. And we were going to get signed to, like, you know, a really big deal with some of the best people in the business. And then that got screwed up when he kind of just went off the deep end and
yeah.
you know, did a drug deal in front of the label, like he put it in his book. The only thing is we didn't leave the next day. But, you know,
yeah.
so, but then the flip side of all of that is I've played with so many people over the years and known ever since I've been a rock kid, hanging out, being a rock kid. And I know people that are great, that practiced like every day, that were like the hardest working musicians and were in so many bands and worked so hard. They never even got to put a record out. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's just like, so there's a flip side to all that too.
Exactly.
And I think about that, you know, so I feel like that, you know, I try not to look back in any bad ways.
It's very true. And we'll get a lot of stuff you were touching on as we go along. But I see Vane as very much the original emo band in the best sense of the word. I mean, your songs always have a very dramatic feel. You've got a strong build. There's a lot of power and emotional weight to it. There's angst. There's passion. And there's this feeling that we're privy to some kind of secret, unexpressed emotion coming from deep inside you. It's very revealing stuff. The only band in metal who even came close to what you were doing was Dokken, but they weren't anywhere near as tortured as you. You know, you always seem like sort of a broken doll crying out for love or something. I mean, it sounds silly, but there's a lot of pain and unfulfilled longing in your music and vocal approach. So where's it all coming from?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm kind of from a long line of singers, though. My mom and her sister were both professional singers, and they were from Holland, and they sang, like, for 10 years and toured
right.
and everything, and then they met American guys and moved here. And so, and my mom, when I was, used to always play, like, stuff, like, listen to how you kind of sing where you cry from or something. I think it's just something inside. I never really had anybody else's voice in my head like some singers do. You know, I've always
right.
liked singers, and most of the singers I like don't really sound like me, but it's
right.
just like, I don't really think about it. I just kind of hear a certain thing, and I let it just kind of come out. And at first,
yeah.
it was almost kind of a downfall because it was so different. And I remember talking to a lot of people saying, you know, one of those kind of artists that's going to need two or three records to really break because
right.
your voice is so different sounding. Like, and they were kind of using examples, even Bon Scott on the hard rock side. It's like, you know, it took them a few records before people could kind of get used to his voice was so different sounding. And then once they did, it was just a sound.
Right.
And, you know, so I don't really think about it. I just kind of, like, try to feel what I'm doing. And yeah, I don't know if you remember that band Orgy. They kind of had a hit.
Yeah.
And they were, like, pretty big Vane fans. Then they had a hit, like, 2 or 3 years after all of that, and they used to tell me, you know, you guys were kind of like ahead of your time a little too much. Now almost everybody does that kind of thing
exactly.
where the verses were kind of dreamy, and then they'd go to a passionate, more bigger chorus, and, you know, that's just
very
kind of
much,
how
yeah.
I felt like writing and how my voice just felt like in the right spot. And I think I listened to a lot of black music, too, when I was younger,
right.
you know, quite a bit, and I'm not sure if that has anything to do with it, but some
it
of
might.
My favorite singers were like, you know, the Isley Brothers and different stuff like that. And then I was in this record club thing, and no one had really turned me on to rock, and you got a record every month if you're a kid, you know, and it's
right.
like, but I was listening to all the black stuff, and then all of a sudden one day there was just, they sent me an Aerosmith record, you know, and I'm like, oh, who's this? So then I put it on, and as soon as I heard that, I'm like, whoa, guitars, rock, you know, I think it took Steven Tyler's voice to kind of bridge me over to that.
Right.
To where
right.
like, because he was still had some of the soul in there, but then, and then I just was like a rock freak from that day on. When I met Steven Tyler, I told him that, and he thought it was pretty funny, so, and then he took me to a strip club. So all my dreams came true.
edition of Third Eye Cinema with our special guest tonight, Davey Vane. In our next segment, we'll be talking some more about his vocal style and unique stage mannerisms, as well as Vane's influence on emo. On the air on Third Eye Cinema.
Cinema. Enjoy it.
And here's my favorite track off of Move On It. This is Whisper. You're also unusually introspective for a metal band, or even for a rock band per se. I mean, there's an enormous amount of self-doubt and, like I said, existential angst in your music. It veers from this dreamy, sort of like depressed ballads that veer almost into Cure territory to these really fierce, angry rockers with, you know, an undercurrent of pain. Like, it's more like you're lashing out than the typical chest beating and posturing you get with metal.
Yeah, thanks. You know what's funny? It's like, that's why I love singing songs like that, because if I can get this mood, I try to make my voice kind of become part of the whole mood and just let it kind of come out, you know, like Smoke and Shadows or something like that used to be my favorite. And my mom used to tell me all the time, there was this singing group called the Andrews Sisters. When I was a kid, she'd watch it and she'd go, look, they're crying when they're singing, and she'd be crying. And I was like, oh, wow, you know, my mom's just so into singing, you know. And then I remember on stage one time before we were signed, we were doing Smoke and Shadows, and I go, I'm going to try to get into that place, that zone where you, and I actually did it, but my voice kind of choked up, so I couldn't do it like them, you know. I couldn't sing for a minute, but so I try to get myself that emotionally, like, wrapped around it, you know, and just kind of get into the zone of what I'm saying instead of just like, I'm gonna sing it now, you know.
Right.
And that's a little bit different than the zone I would get into, like, if I'm singing Beat the Bullet,
right,
or something like that. That's kind of the other side of where it's a little more triumphant, a little bit more telling a story. But when I get into those other things, like, you know, Without You or Smoke and Shadows or Thousand Degrees, those are the ones that I really just kind of get into this other place, and I kind of, it kind of almost comes from the same place you cry or fuck from or something. It's just, you know, and it feels so good to do that, so I just let it kind of channel out, and when it's good, it's, you know, it's happening. So
that really comes
across. And I think you can connect with people then, the people that like us. Maybe some people that took a more long time to get used to, or that wasn't what they liked as much as like an Axl, where every song's just wow, you know, just full on, you know, on the gas. So it's like, who knows, but I think with the people that really dig us, they can feel that I'm connecting with them, you know, I'm connecting with the music.
That really does come across. There's a feeling of authenticity to this. Like, you had to have lived the stories you're sharing personally, and you're still living them and feeling them very much on a surface level. It's like open wounds. You're picking at scabs just to watch them bleed. It's very interesting stuff on several levels.
Yeah, I was a pretty sensitive kid. Yeah, you know, it's funny because No Respect is almost all the songs are true and they're about somebody. And I think it was kind of that was right in the first time that I really, you know, I was young and that was my first big real love. And it was like right around that time when everything kind of, so a lot of the songs are about that, like No Respect.
Right.
So I think that was kind of the peak of the first. You know, it's funny because the first band I was ever in, the one I was telling you about, I came to practice one day, and I'm just a kid, and a guy was just rolling like a big joint or something like that, you know. And he was like a Hendrix dude. We just looked up to him so much. He knew everything about rock, and we were just starting. We were just kids, you know.
Yeah.
So I came one day, and he was playing some chords, and I go, what are you doing, man? He goes, oh, I'm writing this really cool love song, man. I go, wow, that sounds great, because your voice is going to sound really good on this. And I'm like, oh, cool, man. I was all excited, you know. And I go, hey, you know what? I'd really like to try to write some lyrics to that one. And he's like, oh, really? He just looked up at me. And he's like, can you answer me a question? I'm like, sure. And he goes, have you ever had a chick just take your heart out and smash it to millions of people, and you just cried yourself to sleep like a little baby every night? And I'm thinking, that sounds lame, dude. You know? And I'm just like, no, no way, man. And he's like, well, then you can't write a fucking love song. And then I just went, what, you know? But, of course, when it did happen to me, I don't know about the cry myself to sleep every night, you know. But when it did happen to me, then I go, now I get it, you know.
It's true. It's true. That's
those are the best times. I mean, I think that's why our new record came out as good as it did, because I kind of mixed it up a little bit, and I just moved to a different country. And for some chick I met, I knew it was just crazy, but she was just so much other things that I dug, I just ignored every red flag and ended up doing all these crazy adventures all over the place with her. And, you know, it was just mind-blowing and then not always good. So then when I came back to finish the record, when I was on the mic, I just had some stories to tell. When I got them off my chest, they were just, it felt like really good. So sometimes you have to mix it up a little bit, have stuff happen to you. I think that's what happens to a lot of bands, even if they get successful or known. It's hard to write, keep writing cool songs and come from cool places. I mean, the very first time we got signed, they took me into a meeting at Island Records, and they said, and one of the things we had in our contact was artistic control, but they still wanted to give us advice. And they'd broken a lot of really cool bands. So I'm in New York, and they brought me into the office. They go, okay, you know, we got a plan for you guys, and it should be like a 3-record plan. You know, and the third record's the one where you really try to make that one the big one, and these first ones are more for the fans and to gain, like, a legitimate artistic thing. And I go, that's exactly what we want to do. And they're like, so the worst thing you can do right now, what we don't want you to do, is go in the studio right now and try to sound like the biggest band in the world. Because a lot of people do that on their first record. He goes, we already have the biggest band in the world. They're called U2. The reason they're that big is they sold millions of records. They've toured for 10 years. They've done tons of records. They have the experience to be that band now. And he goes, what we want you guys to do is sound like the band we found, a bunch of broke, hungry, horny guys that just want to come tear the world apart, you know, that all live together in the same house. And,
right.
then he looked at me and he goes, and guess what? You two can't make that record. You know, like, they might be the biggest band in the world, but nobody's going to believe that record. And like, you, this is your chance to make that record of the young, horny, broke guys. So we're like, no problem. So it's good work if you can get it. And we really tried to appreciate all the moments of it. Like, when we're in Canada, we did it like 3,000 miles away from home, and we're cruising up to the studio, and we're almost there, and I go, hey, are we at the studio yet? And then the guy goes, it's just right around the corner. I go, pull the car over. And the driver's like, what? You know, so I pull the car over. I go, everybody, let's get out. So the whole band get out. We just all huddled up, and I go, hey, man, let's not go get this record done. Let's go make it. Let's savor every second, because no matter what happens, we're going to get to make this record. You know, they're never going to be able to take this away. We're a bunch of guys from a bunch of guys that all grew up together in a small town, and it's like, let's just go, you know, every note, let's just make it, let's just play it, let's not like try to get it finished and get into some kind of machinery. And everybody's like, yay, and we were so psyched up, and we jumped in the car, and then we turned the corner, we pull up to the studio, the lobby has all these platinum records, and then the guy that produced it standing there with like a flight suit on, oh, hello, you know, we're like, all right, we were so stoked.
I've seen some live footage of you from the early 90s. And the way you move around on stage is very much akin to Roz Williams when he was with Christian Death. And I think you project some of that same vibe, you know, the tortured introvert, bearing your soul to the audience, and particularly to the females in the audience. This is not your typical metal posturing by any means.
And yeah, I don't know too much about him, but thanks.
Because metal as a whole tends to be a far more straight ahead. It doesn't really deal with the sort of emotions that you do on a regular basis, or at least on the level that you do. So, again, where is this all coming from? Is it really just, you know, you're looking at it as an outside thing, like you want to tap into certain vocal, emotional things, or do you actually have something inside you? Because despite the fact that you seem to have a lot of anger that you're expressing, it's a far more introspective, obsessive, almost a feminine approach to it.
Yeah, I don't really know. Like I said, I don't really – I think it's just kind of more – I think every singer is really just a cock with lungs, even if they're a chick, you know what I mean? So I think it's still the basis of singing is still like, you know, the animals that are like, wah, 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 come, you know, and they're basically like, you know, come fuck me, you know what I mean? It's like, you know, noises to attract the other thing. So I think that's part of singing. So when that's coming out, it's that same area, it's part of it. And I don't know, I just want to try to feel it. And it's like when I write a song, it all just comes together like instantaneous. Like I could play the guitar for hours and have a million chord progressions. I'm like, nah, and all of a sudden I'll just hit like a couple. It could be even the simplest thing ever, and all of a sudden I'll hear a certain key, and then the melody, I'll just feel it, and then I'll just kind of like a chord, I'll feel the whole thing, and it'll just want to come out, and it usually comes out the exact same way every time, even if I don't have all the lyrics done.
Right.
I just kind of, it's kind of more just where I'm sitting in it, and I don't really think about it that much. Just whatever the key is or something, you know, I just kind of do it, and sometimes it feels more of that dreamy thing, and sometimes it feels like I want to be more aggressive. And,
right.
You know, I just, you know, it's just something, you know, I don't know how to say it. I'm glad you're enjoying it. You know, I think that's the key, is not knowing really what it is, and you just get to do it. Because I did take a couple of vocal lessons before, and I was really lucky to get the guy that I did, because he brought me in and he just said, okay, cool, we're already playing clubs and doing pretty good. And my manager goes, maybe you should go take some vocal lessons since you never did it. And I'm like, yeah, that's probably a good idea, you know, since I want to be a singer. So I went in there and he just said, okay, you know, I think you need to breathe a little bit better and, you know, be careful, you know, always think of that. I'm like, okay, and he gave me some scales and stuff to warm up on. That's always good. And I go, cool.
Right.
And he goes, so I came like twice, and he goes, you know, I want to come to one of your rehearsals. And I'm like, okay, cool. So he came to the rehearsal, and then he really heard me do my whole thing, and he goes, great, man, I really like what you're doing. He goes, okay. You know, I go, when do I come back? And he goes, man, you don't need to come back now. Just do the things I was telling you and just do those exercises, you know,
right,
the scales. And he goes, because, you know, you already know what you want to do, and that's the hardest thing, and I don't want to mess that up by showing you too many weird techniques and stuff.
Exactly,
because,
right.
You know, he goes, because that's the hardest thing to do in singing is not having somebody else's voice in your head and just kind of having your own style. And he just wanted to make sure that I didn't hurt myself. I've just kind of been doing my thing, and some people don't like it, too. You know, it's funny because once in a while I'll see something in people, you know, since we're talking so much about it, I don't want your listeners to be like, wow, man, these guys think so great or whatever. But sometimes I see things written, the voice you either hate or love, you know, and I'm kind of surprised for a minute, like, oh, that doesn't sound very good. But then I'm like, oh, well, whatever, you know.
No, I've heard that, but it's like, what are you talking about? This guy's got a great voice. But you've got to, I guess it's, you've got to be able to feel where you're going and tap into that. And if you're not feeling that vibe, then I guess you could, you know, who knows what they're thinking. Like you said,
yeah, exactly. So, you know, so it's just like, you know, and I try to have those different vibes, like you said, on the more rocking stuff. I try to be a little bit, I think I'm actually a little more powerful than I used to be even now. Just probably because, like I said, on No Respect, I've really only been singing 3 years. It's not really a lot of time to build it up from my very first exit from my first band.
Right. And you've been known to perform barefoot and to crawl and roll around the stage. And again, this isn't your standard metal performance. It's more akin to like Darby Crash or Mike Ness back in the early days of punk. You're clearly tapping into something deep and primal.
Yeah, I like the stage to just feel like a jungle. Or, you know what, people used to, before I even was in Vane, people always used to call me like Jungle Boy and thought I was like, you know, I consider myself more Greystoke or something. I don't know, I like to just feel like when I'm barefoot, I just walk out on the stage and it just feels like my bedroom or home. You know, I just feel like really relaxed and just the way I move on stage. I don't like to think about stuff too much. I hate, there's nothing worse than that happens. And sometimes, and I can see artists that don't really have it. I'm not saying that, you know, I'm one of the only ones. I think I have that. I'm confident enough to know that I have that extra something to when I go on stage, I can become a real performer. And then I can see people that are just thinking about it the whole time, and then I don't like them as much. And there's other people I can go, okay, he's got the little X factor.
Exactly.
You know, or I can see somebody that's just completely musically just sucks, but then I'll like them because I go, you know what, he's got it. You know what I mean? That
right.
Something happens to him. And what happens is you walk on stage sometime, and it's like a switch. It's not the person you're talking to now. All of a sudden, you just hear the music, and it comes over you. You don't think about anything. You're just singing the songs. You're feeling them. The way you move to this, you do that. You know, it all just happens. And once in a while, I'll do a show, and something will distract me, like a cable or a weird light, and then it's like, and I can't get into that zone, but I can still sing the songs, and I think, okay, now I'm going to go over here, and now I'm going to do this, and when I get off stage, I always feel like, God, that just didn't feel good, and people really don't notice it as much, you know, because they're listening to the songs, and it's still you, but I hate that feeling, you know, so.
I know exactly what you're talking about, because I'm actually a guitarist myself, and it's the same thing. You know, you don't want to think about what you're doing. It sounds stupid. You know, to somebody that doesn't know about what we're talking about here, it sounds counter-logical, I guess. But
yeah,
you really got to get into that zone. And even if you're playing sloppy, people pick up on it. Now, I've had people come up to me, and I'm playing with better players, you know, than I am. And they're ignoring them, but they come running up to me. So, you know, that's what that is. You're tapping into something that people can feel as opposed to thinking about it. Like, oh, look, you know, he's doing these great scales. Who cares? You know,
yeah, and that's
that
what rock and roll is all about. And some people don't even know what that is. They just go up there and play, and it's just they're the same person they were at practice or on stage that night, you know? And that's what kind of is the difference between having that extra feel or something. But if I'm crawling around or something like that, it just feels good. You know, I just like, okay, just being lower on the stage, I can kind of get into a different headspace or whatever.
Right.
And, you know, there's definitely and I've still always go barefoot, too.
On the same line of thinking, what, if any, influence do you think you've had on others? Because, you know, again, I don't know if you want to take credit for this, but the whole emo scene, in a genre not known for sharing feelings, you're always wearing your heart out on your sleeve. It's very intimate.
Yeah, I'm not really too shy to just say what's there. It's just like, I don't know. I mean, I've had people say they were influenced with me, and it always makes me happy. I used to get really scared, like, when the whole thing first went down, and that when I used to worry about everything a lot more because I was so driven and so just on 10 to just work and make it. And then when the whole Seattle thing exploded, and then nobody cared, you couldn't even get a gig as a rock artist, you know. And then I was like, God, that would really suck. And not as many people knew who I was. I go, if somebody came out and just kind of copped my vocal style to the T, and then that would just make it even more torturous, you know what I mean?
Right.
It's like, it's one thing to have the whole thing. It's like you have this religion, and everybody went to church, we were all rock kids, and just we lived and breathed rock and listened to rock, and it was like, you know, part of our whole makeup. And then all of a sudden somebody said, oh, no, all that sucks, you know. And even the people that didn't think that had to pretend that for a while. And I think a lot of people that are younger didn't realize just how bad it was. Like,
even
if you were in a band, you couldn't even be a lead singer. You had to go get, like, a guitar and play it. And, you know, it was like it was all this rules all of a sudden. You know what's funny? During that same time, Gene Simmons of Kiss called me because he was listening to something I was doing with Steven at the time. And that's when the Seattle thing hit. And he goes, hey, man, I listened to your thing, and, you know, we're all fucked now. We're tall. And I'm just like, he was going on and on, you know? And he's like, I'm in the same boat as you, but, you know, you could maybe go cut your hair and act like you're a geek or something, you know? People are going to know it's me. And then after this really long conversation talking about how the whole thing was ruined and rock was dead, he goes, you know what the problem is? Right now, people just don't want to hear a guy running around stage singing about how great his cock is. Then he paused and he goes, ain't it a shame? I thought that was so funny. And then I got off the phone and I called my friends. The God of Thunder just called me and told me rock and roll is dead. It's really real now.
But musically, you don't fit in at all with the tattoo junkie roots rock that was sort of posing as metal in the final days of the genre, or should I say, in the genre's widespread U.S. popularity, which was when you showed up on the scene. You know, Guns N' Roses, L.A. Guns, all those kind of bands with the Aerosmith fetish. You actually had some skills and a talent that a lot of them didn't really seem to, and you had a much better finger on the pulse of the sleazier side of life in the city than most of them did. There's an incredible amount of pathos and darkness and desperation in your lyrics and approach.
Yeah, thanks. Well, Guns N' Roses is pretty sleazy, too.
Sleazy.
Yeah, but, I just really didn't think about it. I knew that, you know, we knew about Guns N' Roses, but we didn't, you know, that just wasn't really what we did exactly. They were definitely a little more bluesy than us. You know, we only had a couple of things that were like that, but we just always kind of just try to do our own thing and just try to make it better. I mean, when we just first started, it was probably, if you heard some of the really early stuff that didn't make it, it was probably even more towards an alternative-y thing, which is funny since alternative, because we live in San Francisco and the places we hang out with, nobody even listened to rock, you know what I mean?
Right.
And, you know, and we go to a shoe store or something like that, some guy working there would like be in some other weird, crazy image. And I think we were influenced a little bit by that and a little of that type of angle into it all, too. But we didn't really, like, overthink it. We just kind of, I just wrote the songs and just felt like we were very isolated, too, you know?
Right.
We didn't practice at a place where there was a bunch of other bands. Like, in San Francisco, we kind of were out of town at the studio and was kind of private. There was only a few bands around that were kind of our friends, and it wasn't like we let anything really influence us, or we didn't really ever chase anything. Like, oh, my God, we got to check that out, you know what I mean? Or this is just a new thing, or we just kind of knew that when we first started, we just wanted to be really over the top when the whole glam thing was going on. We really loved that, and we knew we wanted to be that, but we kind of wanted to do our own version of it, but we didn't want our music to be like that. We always were more influenced by kind of more Coliseum 70s rock, but then it just turned into what our sound was. You know, it's almost like when the Stones or something loved the black music, then they just played it, but it's just turned out like they did, you know? So I wasn't sitting down making an effort, a conscious effort to, like, how can I make this all different? It was just like I was just writing songs and they just came out like that, you know?
Right. But you did still have some of the style that crowd was shooting for, the whole decadent, elegantly wasted vibe. There was a memorable photo that was in the No Respect tape that, to my disappointment, wasn't in there in the CD version that I got in the early 90s.
With the bathtub.
Packed out in the bathtub with Bottles of Jack. It had this sordid Dead Boy style gutter punk feel to it. And it's actually a bit ironic because you did briefly recruit Danny Fury from Steve Bader's 80s goth band, Lords of the New Church, as drummer for Move On It.
Yeah, we did. Yeah, that was pretty funny, too. Well, I saw him at a party before, and so he replaced Steven Adler when, you know, he just decided to finally just call it quits for a while, you know, and just couldn't really hang. And then we thought, well, maybe he's a good guy. And so it was kind of funny, and he liked us, too, so it kind of... And then we just definitely went on kind of more of a musical adventure and just tried some different stuff. And we weren't really worried about trying to figure out how to do whatever you're supposed to do. I just wanted to make music and just keep playing and just make more music. I had some more stuff to say and more things to finish, you know?
You're listening to Third Eye Cinema with our special guest tonight, Davey Vane. Coming up, we talk lyrics, authenticity and sleaze, and the whole mask is mangled. Only here on Third Eye Cinema.
Valdez, singer from... sorry. Hello, I'm Diego Valdez, singer of... Hello, I'm Diego Valdez, singer of Helker, and you are listening to Third Eye Cinema.
Hey, this is Zeep from the band Orden Ogan, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
So next up, as I mentioned, we talk lyrics, authenticity, and sleaze, and the whole mask is Mangle. Plus, we get into the whole deal behind Island Records and No Respect. And speaking of masochism, this is a track off the new album, Enough Rope, which is dedicated to my lady fair, because I just want to worship you.
I'm breaking.
may have already tapped into this one, but I'll ask anyway. A lot of your songs, and just to name a few, Far Away, Shooting Star, Dee Dee, Icy, Cindy, are about people whose lives have come crashing down and who may have not been able to move on after that. You know, damaged goods, really. So how much of this was pulled directly from your life experience, girlfriends, friends, self, whatever?
Well, you know, we were living in a pretty sleazy time, you know. It's like, because we're kind of small town kids, you know what I mean?
Right.
We live in a real small town, like it's called Santa Rosa, where we all grew up. It's kind of a safe little place, you know what I mean? And those are the kind of places where kids grow up that love hard rock. And the stuff we were growing up with listening to, like all the Coliseum rock bands. And we're basically rock kids. And then all of a sudden we moved to the city. Then we're like in kind of, we're living in the Haight-Ashbury, where there's a lot of seedy people and a lot of more alternative lifestyles. And just like the clubs we'd hang out at that lived around the corner, they'd be playing like Bauhaus and people would be on like heroin hanging out and stuff. And it wasn't because of fascists, because they really wanted to get high, you know what I mean?
Right.
It was like later, when it wasn't because I get high, I'll be a legitimate musician. It was like, no, I get high because I fucking killed my fucking brother or something, you know what I mean? It's something. So all of a sudden we're in there and we're doing a completely different thing. We go practice over there. We go to out of town to practice. Then we come back in the city, and then we go play the Stone, which is kind of the place like where all the rock kids from out of town come to, you know what I mean, in the city. So it's like they come from, and those are the kind of people that like rock. But where we lived wasn't the kind of people. We only played that place a couple of times, and they were just more shocked that we were like having all this sex backstage and all this crazy shit, because they thought, we thought these guys weren't as sleazy as us, but they're kind of sleazy in a different way. So, you know, we were kind of safe musically for them. But we'd still hang out there because it'd be walking distance, and the bartenders were chicks, and they'd give us, like, free beer and stuff because we didn't have any money at all. We ate, like, a burrito a day, you know?
Wow.
So, you know, just seeing people like that. And then we started – and then there was, like, a famous strip club there. We started hanging out in that area, and then – yeah, we started getting a little more popular in the clubs, and then the owners were like proud that there was this new San Francisco band. You guys can get in free anytime, and it was cost a lot to get in because it was like fully nude, and the chicks would be going down each other. It was really crazy. So we started like hanging out with those chicks, and they'd take us out, buy us food, and then, you know, started, some people started dating them or screwing them, and then, you know, then the next time you'd go there, they'd be like, you know, doing crazy stuff, trying to make, get people money, and just like, you know, they get on drugs, and someone you know would die, or somebody else you know is like cool, or it's just like you really, they were from some other little place, but they went there and just took it too far, you know, and all of a sudden they're dead, or a junkie, or a hooker, or, you know what I mean, and all of a sudden we're like, wow, all this stuff was just in our faces while we're still exploding into like an artistic thing, so it's just all kind of cross-pollinized, I think.
Right.
And so you just kind of, all of a sudden getting all these new experiences while you're kind of growing up, and you're also growing up being an artist too and trying to figure out how to say stuff in a rock and roll format, which is sometimes kind of limiting in a way too, because it's still rock and roll. So it was definitely an interesting time, and it was a lot of fun too, you know, I mean, I never even went on a real date till I was like in my 20s or something. It's like, if I just met a girl, I'd just go, hey, you want to come to my practice, you know, that was like a date, you know. And they just show up at practice, and you ended up being cool, it became your chick or whatever, you know. You know, so then later in life, I'm like, okay, I go drive to the chick's house, and I pick her up, and then we go somewhere. God, this is a lot of wasted time. What if I don't like her at the end, you know? Usually you hang out and you screw somebody and go, God, that was great. And then you do it a few other times and go, you know what? I kind of like you.
Yeah.
So it's like growing up in the reverse way, you know?
Because you really don't find this kind of direct, jagged-edge human experience being discussed outside the earlier punk scene, you know, back in the 70s and 80s, before it got cleaned up and became the province of, like, teen mall rats, when it was more
like
teen runaways living in squats and having to hustle to survive. That's the vibe you're tapping into. And, you know, I appreciate that because, you know, I've had some of these experiences you're talking about, so you know, that I relate to this. And, you know, nobody's really doing that nowadays.
Yeah, I think it's once you make that commitment, too, okay, we're here – we're young and we're just, you know, we have no, this is all we know how to do. And we've made the commitment. And then you realize, like, wow, this is what life's going to be like if this doesn't pan out because we didn't have a B plan. You know what I mean? You know? So, and you just kind of letting yourself roll with it. Like, this is 100% commitment. Your families and stuff are kind of down on you, too. And you just kind of have to roll with all that. You know, it's just like you've chosen to kind of just really roll the dice. So I think that becomes part of the music too, when you just kind of, you just that's all you know. And like I said that one time, and I think they use it for an eye, going, all you know is rock and roll. You know, you better be good, you know, because otherwise you're not going to have a job, basically. You're going to have a really fun hobby. Yeah, so, and I think the record company one time used that. I heard you say that, use it for, you know, an ad or something, a Vain ad. So it was kind of funny.
Now, especially in songs like No Respect, Push Me Over, Slave, and Worship You, but running throughout your albums, you have a real masochistic S&M undertone to your lyrics. Is this on a conscious level at all, or is it something you really haven't explored or given any thought to? Because, again, it's kind of rare to hear lyrics like this, especially in a hard rock heavy metal framework.
I think I'm just really horny, you know?
You know?
Yeah. You know, I'd like to say some more, you know, some more depths to it all, but I think, you know, it's just like getting back to the bullfrog in the pond or something, except you got a whole microphone and a PA, you know? Just kind of like telling stories and painting pictures and seeing different ways of, like Worship You is a good example. Like, okay, how can I say just how bad I want you? You know, right. It's been said so many billions of times in so many love songs or passionate songs. I just want to try to make it as intense as I can for me, and I just get in that headspace, and then it's just like, okay, I want to worship you. That sounds like, God, that's pretty, that's even a little bit more than I want to love you, you know what I mean? It's just like, and it might not even have anything to do with love, so I just want to get a theme going, and then just really, I think it just comes from like sexual energy, where a lot of rock is from that, you know? It's just like, it's just a primal kind of a thing, you know?
But
and then
that's the
like,
thing. It's usually not that intense. Like you're really, again, we're going back into the circle where you're tapping into something very primal here that, you know, even other rockers are not tapping into. So it's
man, well, that's cool. Thank you. Really appreciate that, you know? Just so, maybe that's why people still know who I am after all this time, because, you know, I had something a little different to offer. You know, if you can come up with a flavor, you know, a brand or something, you know what I mean? It's like, it's means a lot to me. Thank you.
So let's go back to the beginning for a minute. A fair portion of the tracks on your demo, Holding On For Love, wound up on your first two albums, No Respect and All Those Strangers, and the title track wound up on Fade, but others like Deliver the Passion, No Tears For You, they just dropped into oblivion. These are really good songs. So do you have any plans to re-record any of these for an upcoming album? Or maybe
yeah, you know, Deliver the Passion, I don't know. No Tears For You is pretty soft, I always thought, you know? It's like
really?
Probably the most poppy thing in a way, but people love it. You're not the only one. Everybody always says that because that's kind of what we've been doing the last album. We kind of had a theme of bringing stuff back.
Right.
And I was thinking of maybe doing, and we did, it's funny that you mentioned, what was the demo called again you said?
Holding On For Love.
Holding On. It's
right.
Funny they mentioned that one because we did that one again, but we changed the key of it and we kind of messed with it a little bit and it wasn't quite as heavy because on that record
true.
We kind of wanted to do something different. We didn't have quite as heavy guitars because it was kind of more of a jammy record thing, you know?
Right.
And then I was thinking that might be cool to do exactly like we used to do it in the same key and really, you know, make it as heavy as we did on the last record. So that's
right.
One of them. And actually Pretend That You Love Me was going to be on All Those Strangers, or Deliver the Passion, excuse me. And we were doing it, and then it was some kind of political thing because the producer that we were working with at the time had me change a couple of things, and he wanted to have writing credit. So it became kind of a thing between my management and him, and so then they just dropped it off of there. So
right,
we actually had recorded it, and it was coming out pretty cool. Yeah, that might be one worth revamping again, you know?
One of the things that struck me as odd immediately was that after the demo, you were initially signed to Island Records, which was known primarily as a reggae label. They put out albums by Bob Marley, the Militant Rappers X-Clan, Grace Jones. Now, they did have you too, but how did you wind up on that label of all places?
Just because their A&R guy was just so into it, you know, and he just followed us around. And, you know, we'd worked with a bunch of other labels, and they either you know, wanted us to do this or that. I mean, we were going to sign to Epic, and they kept putting us in a category of like, you guys are kind of like a Poison thing, you know? And we just wouldn't say anything because our lawyer said, hey, you know what? If they want to compare you to something that's selling, just don't say anything, you know, because they don't. Then we did this big showcase for them, and they all showed up, and they, oh, man, it was fantastic. We really kicked ass down in L.A. at this thing, and then we pretty much had the whole thing sewed up. But then they brought a bunch of producers down, right? So they called the next day to go, oh, man. So I told our lawyer and our manager that night, and everybody loves it. It's a total home run. Let's talk tomorrow. So then the producers told them, why do you guys keep thinking this band's like Poison? They had the potential to be more like a Def Leppard. They're like really good musicians and can play,
right.
You know?
Right.
So then they got all like, oh my God, well, Poison only sold 2 million. And this, they're telling me this the next day. And Def Leppard sold 10. So how they did it is they got a producer that's a songwriter and they wrote all these hit songs. And we're like, we don't want to do that, man. So we had all this kind of stuff going down. And then all of a sudden this guy from Ireland just kept coming and just really getting what we did. And he used to have his own label and signed some cool Swedish bands. He had a label called Pink Dust. And who's the band that did that song, Good Morning Headache? Smash or something? Smack. So, and then, you know, and he just was like, you know, really had good taste. And so he kept coming and he had long hair and he was young. And so sometimes he'd be backstage and other record companies would come back there and talk to us. They wouldn't even know who he was. They thought he was like one of the crew or something, you know, or a friend. And they'd come in, yeah, you know what I think? Song 2 has a lot of potential for radio and blah, 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 and this other producer. And then they'd leave and then he'd look at me and go, you want to make a record with those guys? So he was really smart because he couldn't really pull the trigger yet, you know, because.
Right.
He knew there was a lot of competition, and he was just kind of biding his time, but he would try to throw us off the trail of some of these other guys, which would have screwed us up anyway.
Right.
So then, you know, and then he'd call me like, oh, you know, like after we wrote 1,000 Degrees, I go, hey, we're going to play a couple new songs tonight. And then he'd call me like after the show and go, oh, man, I can't get 1,000 Degrees. I can't sleep because I'm listening to 1,000 Degrees all night. And I'm like, God, this is the kind of guy we want to work with. And our lawyer had signed, like, everybody from Santana to Boston. So he had all this experience over the years. And he just said, hey, he'd always told us, there's going to be a guy that comes out of the woodwork, and he's going to be the guy. You know, you'll see. And then
right.
And I thought, maybe this is the guy. And they go, you know, if you do a record at Island, you have, like, artistic control. And I go, God, that sounds great, too, you know. So, and then finally, we did one last show in L.A., and Island was there, and so was some people from another company. I think it was Geffen or something. We were at the Rainbow Bar and Grill, which is like a total rock fantasy. So we played a show, sold out, we kicked ass. One table is like half the band and the one record company. The other table right next is the other half of the band and the other record company, and they're running to the phone booth at that time, you know, calling their labels and stuff. And it was like, okay, this is going to be it now. You know, we knew we'd kind of got there because sometimes it takes two people. And then at the end of the day, Island just had the best thing for what we wanted to do. And then maybe a different record company. We didn't know it was going to get sold and be kind of crippled. So we might have got bigger on a different record company, but I don't think we would have ever got to make that record. You know, we would have
right.
I think it was just too raw and too live off the floor. And I don't think people would have just let us do a record that, you know, raunchy. And so, you know, just like hardly any overdubs and just, you know, lots of
right.
Half of it's just like one take live vocals with the band, the way we had everything set up. So I look at it like that, and
yeah.
And like even the night before we left the studio, we're flying like 3,000 miles away, and nobody from the record company or anything was calling my manager or me, and we just had it all. We were going to do pre-production for a week or so first, and I call them and I go, hey man, you know what's up? It's kind of like, you know, no one's saying anything. We're just going to go make the record. You're not even going to be there for like a few weeks, right? And he's like, no. And he goes, well, you know, it's your record. Just do whatever you want. And he goes, so you're going to have 1,000 Degrees and Beat the Bullet. And he named like two other songs. Those are going to be on there, right? And I go, yeah. And he goes, yeah, well, just make sure those are done and then just do whatever you want. You know, it's your record. And we're like, okay. You know, I'm like, this is great. Because at the time, 1,000 Degrees was the song that the record company was just in love with. They
right.
just loved that song. I mean, if you listen to No Respect, that song had the most of the mixing, was
right.
all the time was put in that. Beat the Bullet was just like one of the last songs I'd written before that, and it was kind of just considered like a fun song. And in fact, a couple of people thought I should change the B sections. You know, even the band didn't like the way I sang the B section when I first brought it in, because it kind of goes, when it goes, you've got temptation in your eyes, now
right.
one and one, you know, it's kind of more. And they go, why don't you make that harder, you know, that part? And I go, yeah, but that makes the next part, you know. So
exactly,
there was some discussion
right.
about that, and they're like, oh, okay. And then they got used to it. So we didn't even really think much of that. So 1,000 Degrees, I think they spent like a whole day and a half like mixing it. And when Beat the Bullet came up, I remember the guy that was mixing it, the same producer, he just kind of went, let's see what we're going to do to this one. He just kind of went over and turned the guitars up. That sounds good. All right. Yeah, it's done, you know. It was like that quick, you know. And then it just turned out that we used that one first. And then, you know, in 1,000 Degrees, and they got worried because it said two bodies lying naked.
Right.
Because there was all this weird censorship stuff at the time.
Right.
All of a sudden, even when we did the first video for Beat the Bullet, it got delayed because there was two girls rubbing up against each other, and
right.
it looked like lesbianism, which was funny because, like, you know, a year later they had shows of houses full of gay people, which is fine
right.
to me, but I thought, how stupid, you know? And, you know, so that's kind of how it all went down. And, you know, so Island ended up being really the perfect label for actually getting to make something like that, but then it didn't right. end up being the perfect label for really being able to break us. In Europe, they did a pretty good job, but in America, they never really could kind of get it together. I mean, even the distributing changed the first time we were on the road. And so,
right.
you know, but, you know, it was fun because they were also people that get record deals now. You don't get as much as you used to do then as far as just we kind of went overnight, and that's how Island Records was kind of like a classy thing. They didn't know how to break a band, but they sure that they spent tons of money on you, you know. So it's like we went from all starving together, like in a house, all of a sudden the next day a limo picking us up and taking us to the airport to go somewhere. If we had to go to promotion in England, we'd go to the Hilton, you know. It was like, you know, because we didn't know that, like, it's all going against your owing, but, you know, who cares, you know. So, you know, so it was a lot of fun, too, to go from, like, 0 to 100 like that, which doesn't really happen. Happen now as much.
Right.
You're listening to Third Eye Cinema with a special kid tonight, Davey Vane. Coming up, we talk about the collapse of Ireland and the shelving of all those strangers, grunge in the wilderness years. I'm here on Third Eye Cinema.
For a blue girl, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
This is Rick Ross from Massacre, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
Okay, this is another one off of All Those Strangers. This is Planets Turning.
Thank you.
as you had mentioned, your being on Island also caused some problems for you shortly thereafter, as they had gone bankrupt before releasing your second album, All Those Strangers, which was already past the final mix, completed, and in the can, and I think they'd even done some advanced promotion for it as well.
They did. That kind of hurt. Well, you know what, man, so much stuff happened, just to make it quick. First, it got sold. So the first tour where we were on WEA, then that's who distributes the record. So you'd meet all the people from WEA, and then the cooler people you met, you'd realize, well, wow, Vane's really big in Texas all of a sudden, but you'd meet the people that would work the whole Texas area, and then you go, oh, because they're so good, they're in there just working it, putting the stuff up and getting it to the people, you know? And then all of a sudden, when it got sold to PolyGram, then the distributing changed. So for a while, the records weren't even in the stores. And then All of a sudden, they got it, and then it was new people. Then the president left. And so then we had a new president, and he had to come see us play. So it was almost like getting signed all over again, you know, like what if he showed up and didn't like the band? But He liked the band, and then he said, hey, you know, stick with it. And he kind of followed through all his promises. Then when we were mixing the record, like you said, then he left, and then they just decided that they weren't going to do rock. At first they said they were going to put it out, and it would hurt because it was already ads in Japan and pre-release cassettes of the whole thing would be out. So after everything went down and we were no longer with them, like in Raw magazine in Germany, the top 10 readers poll, I think it was number one was like Ozzy or Metallica, and then number two was Vane pre-release cassette, you know, and then it was like, you know, it was like, so it made it even worse. It's like, not only is the record not coming out, people already have it anyway and like it, you know?
Right.
You know, and so we were just like, oh man, it was tough. That was a tough one to swallow, just having it out already too. But then, you know, you just got to move on, something you can do about it.
But apparently the album had vanished from their vaults before it, somehow you finally acquired the masters and then released it 20 years on your own Jackie Rainbow record label. So
yeah,
exactly. About that mess.
Well, because they didn't care at that point. I think they just don't even really. They just said, yeah, you can have it. You know, it's just, you know, the whole thing is just such a bad thing. But you know what? That happens to a lot of bands, but most of them, it's their first record.
Right.
I mean, it could have just as easily been our first record because it was already sold when we were doing our first record. So they could have just, and they used to spend a lot of money on stuff back then. I mean, we could have made that record for a lot cheaper the way we made it, you know? But it's just back then, that's just how they did it. You just spent like $250,000 to go do a record. You just, everybody flies places and you just waste, and the studios cost like so much. And it was just like, even if you're doing a raw rock record, it costs as much as if you're trying to do a produced one, you know? It's like you're in the same place and for the same amount of time, you know? So we spent more time going, let's just sound like we knew the Paul and you do the Charvel. Okay, nah. Okay, you two Pauls. I think we got it. All right, let's go try a take. And I go sing, you know? We did more stuff like that than actually recording. You know what I mean? So it's just like, that could happen too. So the whole thing was a mess and it took a while to get over, but, you know, I got into the road crew thing with Steven Adler and just started just writing new songs and just kind of kept banging away at it, you know? It wasn't really till after that, then we got the Fury guy, and then we did the third album, Move On It. And after that came out, it wasn't until after that that I went, okay, now I'm just going to take a break and just only play music and not try to sell records or not try to make it or do anything anymore. And then the band kind of drifted off, and I just got me and Ash and a drummer, and I just went and got a studio, just a rehearsal room, and we just play music, just to play music, not for any reason at all, after all that crazy roller coaster ride. And some days we'd come and I wouldn't even sing some days. I'd just play like guitar solos, and we'd just like experiment on weird jams and stuff, you know what I mean?
Right.
And then we'd just leave and go, okay, that felt good. We're just playing music again. We're not trying to, you know, survive or figure out how to do it or wait for label or see if they're going to promote it or just, you know, or see if somebody's going to be on drugs or, you know what I mean? It was just for the pure musical sake of it. And then after a couple months of doing that, then somebody called me and said, hey, do you want to do a record? I wasn't even trying. And I thought, hey, that sounds kind of cool. Maybe we'll do a record. And then that's when we did the Fade record.
Yeah, just to set up this whole period, because right there where your Poison was a major success, or at least you should have been, you had the Island Fiasco eating your second album. And then out of nowhere, grunge drops, and for all intents and purposes, it kills the metal scene in the U.S. You know, all of a sudden, like you were saying earlier, long hairs, flashy clothes, fretboard mastery has become an overnight joke, and musicianship gets denigrated in favor of this snotty college hipster junkie noise. It was really a sad and sorry time for music.
Yeah, but even people like Led Zeppelin were considered bad or something. It was just like, but if you were from Seattle, you could survive it. Like, we played plenty of gigs with Soundgarden, and they were just a little different, but the guy was still running around with no shirt on, screaming, and chicks wanted to screw him, and they were just, you know, partying. They were like a rock band, you know what I mean? And same with Alice in Chains and stuff. But since they were from Soundgarden, then he just kind of cut his hair and played the guitar, and he could kind of slip into the whole thing. So it was a time, and that's pretty much what really did it, because even when the road crew thing with Steven Adler didn't work because of the drug thing, which everybody in our camp thought, okay, this is going to be how Vane makes it, because it was kind of almost Vane anyway. It was Jamie, me, and Ash, and kind of the same sound and the same songs, but Steven's drumming was just a little more over the top. So even that would, and he had so many fans that seemed like the vehicle, and the deal we were going to sign was going to be pretty, like, they were going to have to push it because it was just so big, you know? But John Klogner was the one that was involved in that. So when it fell through, he still really liked me and the songs and stuff, so I think we could have bounced back and done something else with him, but then when the grunge, so it could have led to something else, like in the normal avenue of things, and I felt like I was still getting better all the time too, you know, because I'd never really stopped. But then after the Seattle thing exploded, then nobody even wanted to make him make a record. He's the guy that brought you, like, all the stuff that everybody hated. Now, even Guns N' Roses was not considered good anymore, you know what I mean?
Right, exactly.
Which was funny. It's like Nirvana's like a punk band, but, you know, the Guns N' Roses record sounds more like a punk album to me. But I didn't think they were bad, but I thought the Nirvana sounded more like the Police or something, you know? You know, I really did. They kind of reminded me of that, just sort of like the way the melodies were, even though you screened and stuff, and maybe they were coming from that, but that was a really produced record. But it was the same company that brought you the last biggest band, so it's like, maybe it's not a coincidence.
Well, and on top of that, on top of the grunge thing even, in the 90s, the whole rap thing, which had been going on since the early 80s in a more lighthearted vein in urban sectors, it blows up into the mainstream, first with political stuff like Public Enemy, Arrested Development, and then it gets into this whole ridiculous gangster thing. You know, they have a few high-profile murders, and all of a sudden, every suburban white kid starts running around with their pants around their knees, pretending they grew up hustling in the ghetto. I mean, it's just bullshit.
Yeah, I know. So it just never really opened back up again. You know, then grunge got destroyed by rap, you know?
Right.
Then that was, you know, and I didn't really mind it. I would have understood it a little more if it would have been two guys with a keyboard from England or something with a funny haircut, you know what I mean?
Right.
But it was the same thing, you know what I mean? It was like, okay, why is this so different? It's a bunch of guys blasting away at the guitar, and they're on drugs trying to get laid, you know what I mean? It's the same, you know? It's like, it's not that much different. I understand maybe there's a new slant on it, and maybe that new slant is considered better, but it doesn't mean everybody else has to go away. Where, like, you know, even when every other big band came out, like when Def Leppard became the biggest band in the world, then the bands that were before them were considered not quite as cutting edge, but they were still there.
Yeah.
Same with Motley Crue became big, then the other bands, they would just kind of go, oh, maybe we've got to wear those pants or something.
Right.
Or, you know, Guns N' Roses broke. Some of the bands that had more guys with Charvels and not the cool vintagey thing Guns N' Roses had to go, hey, I better not play this guitar so much anymore. It was like, it became more of a fashion thing, but people still listened to Motley Crue, even though they were considered not quite as cutting edge as that, too. You know, or the Scorpions or old bands or Led Zeppelin. It was still the lineage. It kept going. It was the same, you know, there was always just it was like the heavyweight champ. There was just a new champion, and he had a new style, and you either followed it or you kind of got out of the way, but it didn't make you all, but you were all still in the fight game, you know? And then when the grunge hit, it was like, the fight game's over, you know what I mean? This is like, you know, that's done. This sport has been canceled. Anyone involved in this sport is no longer allowed to play, you know? So it was kind of strange. It was really felt like the religion you had been canceled. You know, like you went to church one day and they said, oh, you know what, sorry, man, your minister said, we found out that there really isn't a God. Sorry about all that shit you put in. You know, and you're like, you know, it's like, okay, I guess I'll go away now.
Thank God for Europe, Japan, and some other corners of the world where they never really fell for all this, and metal's remained an important style of musical expression, because these days in particular, in addition to the underground and the gothic symphonic sound that's always been popular outside these shores, there's been a lot of activity with old bands getting back together, the traditional sound making a bit of a comeback. You know, the old scene is getting some of the respect it's due again. Not that you really know it over here. You know, we're still stuck with the Pantera thing and the rappers. You know, I can't figure that out. But at least now some of this is starting to make a comeback and getting some the respect it's due finally.
Oh, yeah, totally. And in Europe especially, it's like there's just so – they really love that whole era of rock and all the old bands. Because it's never really going to die. There's always new generations that digs it and just hears something different in it.
Exactly. And yet, like I mentioned earlier, what's fascinating is that you basically kept going through the heyday of grunge and more recently got just about the entire old band back together for your last two albums. It's bizarre to hear last year's Enough Rope and realize that this thing's from 2011, not 1991. And, you know, this is your strongest album since All Those Strangers, hands down.
Thanks, man. Thank you very much.
The truly amazing thing about your music is that I could put on just about any Vane album from No Respect to Enough Rope, and there's not a hell of a lot of difference. It's all very similar in style and quality and sound. Your voice is pretty much the same as ever, as are the guitars and the lyrics. You really are an amazing band, and I salute you guys for sticking to your guns and not really changing with the times and trends. I mean, you move with the trends a little bit, but it's really the same sound all the way through.
Yeah, thanks. Well, if you got a sound, then you got to stick with it. You know what I mean? It's like,
exactly.
You know, I've got my friends that are just like, you know, you've got your own sound, so you don't have to worry about figuring something out. Or I'll sit in with some people sometimes, and they'll be jamming, and they'll be a completely different band, and then, you know, they'll sound kind of like this Black Sabbath-y kind of thing. You know, one time I was working with them in the studio, and they were jamming, and then I go, I was getting the PA because we were going to do some pre-production. I go, hey, I'll jam on something. And I started singing. They go, how did you make it sound like Vane? You know, so it's kind of funny, you know, because it's Vane's just guitars, drums, and my voice. So it's like the same thing. But I think Jamie really did some amazing guitar stuff on the new record,
yep,
too, you know.
He did. I was going to say, speaking of the guitars, you play yourself. And on two of my three favorite Vane albums, All Those Strangers and Enough Rope, you're listed as doing both vocals and guitar. But for more than half your career, you've been exclusively on vocals and let Danny and Jamie handle that end of things. So why is that? Because, you know, if you compare yourself to, like, Leatherwolf, they were able to pull off a three-guitar lineup. And the three of you guys are all comparably good players. It's not like I noticed someone standing out or slouching in particular.
Well, I used to play a lot when we first started because at first it was kind of a trick. And
right.
I'd wait and just sing when people didn't know who we are. And I'd wait till the last part of the set. And then Jamie would take his guitar and, like, throw it all the way across stage. And I'd catch it. And then I'd do every lick I knew at a million miles an hour. And then we started having guitar battles between him and me because Danny didn't play as many leads when we first started. You know, he was more
right.
rhythm guitar player. And then on No Respect, I played on Ready, one of the leads, and I played the end lead of Without You. So I had a couple
right.
solos on there. And we always carried a rig. We used to tour with six Marshall half stacks, and I'd have two half stacks just for me that would just be on lead volume. So I'd play guitar almost every gig, and I play pretty much on every record. And then even on this record, I've got some leads, like on Hot Stage Lights and some rhythms
right.
and stuff on the first lead, and then Jamie did some other stuff. But now the last couple tours, once in a while I'll grab somebody's guitar and do something, but I'm just kind of like, okay, that's one last thing I don't feel like dealing with tonight. But we used to do a thing where I would just trash the guitars or just lay on top of them, and at the end, you know, we used to have three or four of my guitars that we'd send back constantly to get fixed because they would just get too trashed out for me laying on them. So it was kind of part of the show, too, you know, when the
right.
And then we'd have three guitars, but we wouldn't do it the whole time. Because I think it's kind of boring to have a guy with a guitar as the front person anyway.
How did you manage to get the entire band back together for this one? Because it's not like it's one or two key members. It's everybody. That in itself is pretty unique.
Yeah, well, you know, because we're still buddies. Well, Jamie could do a lot of this stuff because he's got his own amp company. And then Ash, and then we have a couple. There's actually three drummers on the album because it's our drummer before Louis Snore, before we had Tommy came back. So he was on a couple tracks, and Adler's
right.
on a couple tracks. So, you know, people just wanted to throw in and contribute. You know, I'm happy how it all came out.
You're listening to Third Eye Cinema with a special guest tonight, Danny Vane. In our last segment, we'll be talking about Road Crew, the 90s albums, and the solo record, only here on Third Eye Cinema.
Brian Day of the Vladimirs, Sono Morte, and any other metal band that you know that I have been a part of, and you are listening to Third Eye Cinema, and you should continue to listen to this until your ears bleed.
Hey, I'm Marcus Thomas. I'm the guitar player and vocalist for the Vladimirs and Sono Morte, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
Hi, this is James Murphy. You're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
And from the solo record, In From Out of Nowhere, this is Push Me Over. Run through the albums, and if you have any anecdotes from behind the scenes or comments you'd like to share about the circumstances at the time or their reception, feel free to elaborate. The demo, Holding On for Love, was this recorded at several different studios or sessions? Because it seems like every track has a slightly different sound quality from the one before it.
I don't even really remember. I mean, I don't remember that being – it's called Holding On for Love, huh?
Yeah,
I mean, I don't remember that we actually had one that was called that, but maybe we did. You know what I mean? I know we did Holding On for Love. I remember the very first demo we had just had Laws Against Love. Not the very first, but the big demo we had was called – we just had Laws Against Love and Ready on it, and that's the one we were really pushing. And the Laws Against Love – that was our first, like, wow, now we've got a sound, kind of. And people would go, wow, it's like sounds so different, but I like it. So, and then we recorded kind of in this little studio in Santa Rosa. And then we recorded some stuff in our light guy's house. I think that's where we did Holding On, in his living room. So just different things and just kind of in that stage where you just kind of do it just for the music and just for the fun of it. You just, you know, you're not really sure. It wasn't like a professional thing, like we're going to take you guys in the studio and do this or that. It's like we were just, that's just what we did. You know, we recorded and made art, but it was a little more difficult than it is nowadays because you'd have to have somebody with equipment or go to a place and pay.
Now, we've addressed No Respect a lot, but you also filmed a video for Beat the Bullet and then another for Who's Watching You. So how well did that exposure work for you? Did the videos result in a big sales uptick, or is it more of a gradual thing like touring where you're just kind of getting your name out there?
Yeah, no, especially Beat the Bullet. By the time Watching You came out, the record company was pretty toasted, you know what I mean? So it's like that was like kind of just on there and just only the hardcore real rock fans, which isn't enough to really break you in America, you know what I mean?
Right.
It's like they probably didn't see much of it. More people see it now probably than then. But Beat the Bullet was definitely got people into the band and got us out of the gate because they could see that we had the cool image and, you know, the chemistry, which I think is really important. And you could see that in a video and the song, and it was raw. And so that definitely got us going. So, but that came out like almost at the same time with the record and everything. So I'm not sure, you know, what, and we were on the radio and stuff like that too. So,
and I'll tell you, there were several years where I'd moved on from metal, since what was past our metal in this country, like we were talking about, was just this kind of screamcore aggro crap with pretensions towards industrial rap. I mean, it's just complete dog shit. But even during that time, which obviously was like the 90s, there was one album I kept pulling out, one song I used to keep playing to people, and that was No Respect. I mean, the desperation, this masochism, this, let's be fancy, the creed de coeur of that song in particular were just inescapable, particularly during some years when I was going through my own long, dark night of the soul, so to speak. So your music was always with me, even though I wasn't even aware you were still recording at the time.
Well, thanks, man.
Then you got All Those Strangers. You know, what a great album. I'm so glad that you finally rescued it and released it all these years later. I think the versions of Planets Turning and Shooting Star here were a bit stronger, maybe a little more fresh and intense than the ones that you had put a Move On It and Fade, which were a little more tempered, like you were saying.
Yeah, no, you're right. Yeah, that's when we first did it. You know what I mean? So it's like, you know, they were definitely fresher and more in your face.
Plus, you get Freak Flag, which is another of my favorites. Love, Drug, Far Away.
That's me and guitar. That was my guitar thing for that record. It's pretty sloppy, but yeah, it was just yeah, that was definitely an interesting record to make.
It's one of your strongest albums, Alto, which makes it all the more tragic. It was lost for so many years. I think building off No Respect, if that had come out, you could have really skyrocketed that one, if not for
that's
the
what a lot of people thought. Well, that's what we went with the guy we had. I didn't really enjoy making the record with him as much as our first record. He was a little more anal and a little more like, I'm the producer, be here at 10 in the morning. We're like, hey, we don't play at 10. He goes, well, it's my schedule, I'm the producer, you know. So the whole thing was a little more regimented, and the fact that we dropped a song, and he was always like worried about the budget and like, okay, you come back to LA. We did it in LA, and then the band will stay here. And I wasn't used to just being by myself and just singing with the producer without the band around to get me all pumped up and doing the kind of overdubbing the vocals instead of us all just playing together. And so it was just kind of more, just there was a lot of, we tried to make it as good as possible, but I remember not really enjoying the process quite as much, you know what I mean? And then it was just even worse when it didn't come out on top of it then, you know, then it was like, oh, God, you know. But it was interesting, too, while we were recording it, which was kind of a strange synergy. I'm walking down the hallway of the studio, and there was only two studios where we're recording in LA, and all of a sudden I see Kirk Hammett, and he's doing the Black album at the same time. And it was weird. I'm like, I'm there at the studio recording, and he's the guy that gave me my first like little break, produced my little first demo because he heard some guy that he thought had a cool voice. You know what I mean? And I'm like, okay, now I'm in a major recording studio doing my second album with that guy, you know? So it was like, so then it didn't come out. So maybe it made a full circle, like, you know? So, you know, I'm not sure what happened.
you kind of already addressed this earlier on, but what was with the whole brief Road Crew interlude? Because after the Island thing, you lost Danny and Tom, and you wound up doing this with Steve Popcorn Adler from Guns N' Roses. Why didn't this project really get off the ground? Was he still as messed up as he had the reputation for?
Yeah, that's the only reason it didn't. Well, I wasn't really even interested in doing it because I didn't want to break up the band. So basically what happened is he was always a fan of Vane and would wear our sweats and, you know, just always like, oh, man, I love you guys, because we play with them once. And he'd always followed it, and some of their roadies were like some of our Santa Rosa childhood friends, too, that – you know, we're buddies, so it was, like, cool to have a guy that was in the band that much in one of the biggest bands in the world, if not the biggest rock band in the world, they were, I guess. So then when he saw that we got dropped from Island because the company got sold and went bankrupt and all that stuff, he called me and said, hey, man, I got a thing. I want to start my own band, and you're my favorite singer, dude, and I got Prince's manager, and, dude, you know, let's check it out. I go, hey, dude, thanks. I'm really flattered because I know you can get probably anybody you want, but you know, I'm all together now, and I went to rehab, and I'm just like, but, you know, we're gonna still try to do some stuff with Vane. And we'd already played a few shows since then, and rehearsals were getting kind of down, and everybody was just kind of, like, fried from everything that had happened, you know, after just 2 years of straight, because nothing had ever gone down for us. It had only gone up, and then it went, you know, just up and up and up, and just all of a sudden down, like hard down, you know. So I said, you know, no. And then the next day, Prince's manager calls, you know, like, man, I really dig your voice. And I go, hey, you know, that's cool, but, you know, thanks a lot, and body blah. So then all of a sudden, then Prince's manager goes, hold up, my manager and my lawyer. So then they want to have a meeting, and they said, no, you know, you've got to check this out. My manager and lawyer, you don't know. You've got to check this out. You don't know how kind of trouble you guys are in, and this is, Rick, really bad. You've got to at least check it out and just see what happens and take as many guys as you can with you. It's kind of like their message to me, and I go, man, wow. I really kind of went kicking and screaming and didn't want to do it because all these guys were my best friends, but it felt like the end was near anyway because everybody was getting kind of disillusioned, you know what I mean?
Right.
And then, so they had an all meeting together, and, of course, the drummer felt the worst because he was the guy that was going to get aced. It did go good.
Right.
But we still talked about it, all his friends and brothers together, and they just told us just how serious it is because we had tried to get another deal, but then they wanted the records. They wanted No Respect and All Those Strangers, and it was a new company called Giant. But then Island didn't want to give those up. So then we knew that no one was going to sign us without getting our catalog, too. You know?
Right.
So then it was like, so we're really in bad time. So anyway, everybody goes, okay, well, I'm going to just go check it out. Let's just check it out. And everybody said, okay, that's fine. So then Steven came and we just jammed with everybody except for our drummer. And we talked about it. We just to see if he can play. And he sounded great. And he had his shit together. And he seemed like he was together, you know. So, okay, that sounded great. And then he goes, okay, here's the plan. This is, you know, so they just worked out the business thing. And I was going to write all the songs. And everybody said, okay, let's just do it. And then I just took Jamie with me. Because then the other goes, let's just take, I just want one guy, you know, and then we'll get some new guys. And I'm like, okay, let's try it for a while. And then while we were trying that's when Danny decided to go do his own thing, and Tommy wanted to do his thing, and then Ash went to do his thing. And everybody just kind of thought, okay, it's kind of over. Then I had to just beg Ash to come check it out. I was like, dude, if you're my best friend, you'll come here. He goes, dude, I'm not going to come, man. I don't want to do it. And I'm like, I just had to talk to him for 2 hours. I go, if you're really my best friend, you just come here, put your bass on and play one song and leave. You know what I mean? I'll pay your plane ticket. You know, so I begged him like a girl. And finally he did it. But then when he heard how good it was, because it was really sounding good, we'd worked Steven probably harder than he ever worked in Guns N' Roses or any other band in his life. You know what I mean?
Right.
We were just like, double time. And then Jamie crank on some leads for 5 minutes, and he'd be over there going, holy shit. You know? So, you know, it was pretty fun. And then, so then when we got it all together, then it was like, that's kind of how the whole process happened. But then after that, once he felt comfortable and we got the whole lineup together, started doing a couple shows, doing some great recordings and getting some attention, then it was just like, then he just felt comfortable and started partying again, kind of a little more hardcore, and then started kind of losing the grip of everything. But it was funny doing the showcases with them because the record companies would show up, and after we are done, you know, they're kind of like checking it out, and usually they just go, okay, great, and they leave, and then Steve would always go, hey, what do you guys think, man? And they're like, oh, yeah, and he goes, well, I don't know what your problem is. If I was you, I'd sign us right now, man. Like, I sold 50 million records, and he goes, and these guys sold, like, hundreds of thousands of records. It should have been way bigger. They're, like, my favorite band. And then we had one new kid that was Sean Rory was his name, and he was a guy that we recruited from San Francisco that was going to be the new hot guy that we'd watched kind of from afar, and we go, hey, we'll get him. And then he'd look at Sean, and he goes, and the little fellow over here, well, he's just a lucky guy. And then they'd be shocked looking like somebody would just say it like blatant, like, you're not going to sign us? What's wrong with you, you know? Yeah, it's like, so, you know, but then we had John Klogner come check it out, and then he was really into it. And then, you know, the whole thing, you know, we kind of faked them out a little bit by not letting them know just how bad it was and trying to help them and keep them together. And, you know, then it was more because he was my good friend, too. I didn't even really – I kind of forgot about all that other stuff because then I got into like, hey, man, we really started connecting and caring about each other, and I just didn't want to – I knew if I split, maybe he would die or something bad would happen, too. It was kind of more about trying to help him as much as I could, you know, because it seemed like he was kind of ready for that at that time. But then, you know, it just – didn't work. So, you know, we even hung out after the band broke up and he came up here and hung for a while and tried to make it happen. But then he just kind of, I'm glad he made it through all that, you know, then he kind of finally said screw it and kind of gave up for a while, even trying to play music or do anything. But, but he still, every time I see him, he still apologizes to this day. He goes, dude, I'm so sorry about that.
Move On It and Fade. Like I said earlier, I had no idea you guys were even still a band at this time, 94 and 95.
Yeah, I don't think many people did.
They were really dark years for music in this country. There's really nothing. These were Japanese-only imports. Now, Obsession recently did that as well with their last album, and I know that Japan was like Europe, was one of the countries that still retained an interest in metal during the 90s and 2000s, but was that the only motivation for doing an exclusive overseas release?
Yeah, well, it's because they were because that was the same record company that put out No Respect in Japan, too. So that was like being like on a major in Japan, really. So then we thought the motivation was they were going to pay. And back then, you had to have money to make records, you know what I mean?
Right.
It wasn't like now where you can just get your Pro Tools rig and get your buddy and maybe try to rock out or whatever. So they were into it, and, you know, we knew it was still a way to keep playing music and making records, and I still wanted to get some of the songs out. So, like I said, the first one I was kind of surprised. Fade I was a little surprised about, but, you know, Move On It, we were just still kind of pushing it and got a new drummer, and all the songs that we had been playing with Adler and recorded, we wanted to use those. I mean, to me, songs are like children or something. I want them to see the light of day if I care about them. And I thought after all those Strangers, now all the stuff we just did with Steven is going to get wasted too, you know? And that's just like, so, I was really getting frustrated, obviously.
So Move On It's basically like the road crew album that never was.
Yeah, there's a lot of road crew tracks on there and new ones. Yeah, like if you look at the credits, Breakdown is pretty much really road crew. Family, I mean, a lot of it really is road crew. Then we just I just wrote a few more songs and we added them and re-recorded that, and it got us a way to get to let people hear what we were doing, because I don't like to re-record stuff that much unless it's like years later or something, you know?
Yeah, when you hit Fade, you know, you had already carried over some more tracks from the demo and some tracks from All These Strangers, plus some new tracks like, you know, DD Land Low, Quick Step to Love.
Yeah,
I found Whisper particularly interesting. It was very dark and obsessive. It was similar to Queensrÿche's Gonna Get Close to You in tone. There's something about the lyrics and persona that you have, at that, especially at that time, that kind of screams early Prince, you know, when he's still interesting. That same dark, you know, the introspective, obsessive feel, the extreme passion, absorption in sex. I mean, it's almost palpable.
Yeah, that was a fun one. I remember when I was writing the lyrics, Danny Fury was in the other room, and it was about this chick that I met, and then I was like, really? And then he heard me singing it, you know, because I was working on it, singing it, and he's like, yes, don't change that. You know? It was one of the only ones I had somebody, like, hearing what I was doing in another room, but I couldn't stop, you know. He's like, that's it, don't change it. Yes, that's been a favorite for a long time.
And then there was nothing from Vane per se for a decade. So why the 10-year gap between Fade and On the Line? Did you just decide that that was enough since you weren't getting enough support on these shores?
No, because I did, because the record was called Davey Vane. It's still really just the same thing, really, you know?
Yeah, I was going to say halfway through the decade, you released that solo record, which the way I know it is In From Out of Nowhere. And
it's not really a solo record. I mean, when Fade's probably more of a solo record than that, you know? It's just people think it is because it just says Davey Vane. But, I mean, on Fade, I played almost all the guitars and did pretty much a lot of it, you know, by myself, too. So the only reason we actually did that on purpose, because we already had Jamie back. We had Ash. Danny was even playing with us a little bit on some of the stuff. But right when we put that out, we're just, you know, if we call it Vane, then if we're going to go play, we're going to have to play it. People are going to come and expect us to play like Secrets and Beat the Bullet and all of the stuff. And right now I just really want to play it like all these new songs. So, you know, I didn't think of it like, I would have known, I would have never called it that, because now people have been the solo record and, or, you know, it's like, you've only done, Vane's done this many records and you've done one record. And I'm just like, to me, I've done all of them, you know?
Yeah,
so I didn't really think of it like that. So, but at the time we thought it's a good idea. And a couple of the guys go, I don't know how much longer I can do it for. And maybe you should just call it Davey Vane and be more about you. And, you know, and then when we go play, you can do whatever you want. And I go, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. So that's kind of why we did it. But I didn't do it any different than the other record. To me, it's still considered a Vane record. I might have to just repackage it and call it Vane and re-release it.
I picked up on that because I was going to say it seemed like the Paul Stanley solo album from 78 because, yeah, maybe it was a little milder, a little jazzier, but it just sounds like a Vane album. So why did you do a solo album? But you just explained that.
yeah, it wasn't really, you know, because it's like they're all sort of like that in a way, except that just have more this is the most extensive interview I've ever done, bro.
That's the way I roll.
Which is cool. But I'm starting to kind of get fried, too, you know. So, and plus, they're calling me at the office because I'm producing this thing for them, and everybody's really trying to get a hold of me.
And to close out this half of our interview with Davey, we have this track from Fade. This is Holding On. Debut.
and stay tuned for one last track from Vane after the close. If you'd like to contact us here, comment, suggestions, or you're a filmmaker or musician who'd like to join us on air, email us at thirdeyecinema@hotmail.com, visit our website, thirdeyecinema.wordpress.com, or our Facebook page, facebook.com/thirdeyecinema. Of course, we've got the Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio. part of this episode. All Blog Talk Radio shows are available for download, archive, or listen at your convenience. See you next week.